The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back as we head into hour two, 602-508-0960. We were talking about D-Day a bunch in the first, and some cultural issues related to it and America then and now. Got a few more calls on that. Happy to take them, as many as you want. Elaine is in Buckeye. Welcome to the show, Elaine. How are you?
Good, thank you. I love your show, and I love calling in when it's pertinent.
Well,
I always am appreciative of the opportunity that you give people to share
Thank you. Your show, which is great. Thank you.
I've talked to you in the past about, you know, the brofy kind of political mindset that they have been using towards kids and history and things like that I feel like I have to go against the tide. I you know, sent my son there for religious purposes, but at the same time got a whole bunch more that I didn't want. So I've had to go the other direction and really support my grandfather, which is my two boys' great-grandfather, who served in World War II with the 12th Armored Division and the 56th Armored Infantry Battalion.
Wow.
And headquarters company. And I have all his old documentation and such. So we are going to be going on a 25-day tour to Europe with both boys to actually go to some of those battlefields, Herlesheim. We're going to go, you know, wherever they went, as well as, you know, hitting some of the other big cities that they didn't get to go to. But,
oh, my gosh.
Just creating that experience for them has really been an eye-opener for them because they feel connected to it. And
that's
their history. It's all of our history.
That's right.
When you talk about creating men that are going to be those people in the future, this is kind of, I think, maybe how I can do it.
Oh, my gosh. I just, how fortunate your boys are and what a great thing you're doing. This is, you know, it makes me think a little bit about an old speech of Abraham Lincoln's, sometimes referred to as the electric cord speech, 1858, I believe, where he was talking, it'd be fun to read with your boys. He was talking about how we no longer, have the heroes or any of the men still living really from the revolutionary moment, from the revolutionary period, from 1776. So what ties us to them, he asked, you know, rhetorically, what ties us to the founders of this country? What is that electric cord? And that electric cord, he said, was, of course, our devotion to their ideas and ideals, obviously, especially certainly the Declaration of Independence. And the idea of that we hold these truths to be self-evident. It was the ideas that they fight for and fought for. That was the electric cord that created the new generation's memory, that connected the new generation's memory, the new American's memory to the old. For you to do this with history and for you to do this with the ever competing fight between good and evil and justice and injustice and what your father and grandfather fought for. Just what a blessing, Elaine. What a blessing. How fortunate your boys are to have you and how fortunate a thing you are doing with them. I hope you will call back when you come back.
Sure.
And I will ask you
Absolutely.
To do one more. I would like to have your boys on the show to talk about it, too. It's certainly a better education.
They would love it.
I would love to hear what they learned. And they could write or call, either way. And yes, of course, as my producer is pointing out, this is far better education than they would get in any school. So God love you for doing it. Just God love you.
Well, and they would love that. They are half Navajo Indian, so they are tied to our country as Native Americans, but they are also tied on my side, understanding well, what did we gain and what did we lose?
Yeah.
And what did we gain in becoming America? And they are part of both worlds.
Oh,
and
wow.
So just for them to really appreciate what their great-grandfather has
incredible.
Done.
Incredible.
And they're both very political. My oldest is going to be going to the Ford Public Policy School to get his graduate degree there. And my other one is just as much of a history buff. So they really know where we're going and what happened there and how the flanks came in. And they're just really getting a holistic approach to America.
Yes, they are.
From Native Americans to World War II.
Yeah, they're two kinds of Americans, aren't they? I wonder if it might be fun for you to show them. It's easy to do on a computer. To show them Reagan's D-Day speech on the 40th anniversary from 1984, you know, the Boys of Pointe-à-Hawk speech.
Yeah.
It might be fun to show them that. And then when you do show them that, because he is talking to your boys' great-grandfathers. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the crowd that was when he said these are the boys. He made those boys young again. They were the soldiers who fought in Normandy. And This might give you a little bit of a chill, assuming you and I are roughly in the same age category. It gives me a chill when I think about it. Huh? You think we might be? I think we might be. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I'll stick with that. That works. You probably remember that speech.
Yeah.
Okay.
Get a load of this.
This will freak you out as it freaks me out every time I think about it. He gave that on the 40th anniversary of D-Day, 40 years from 1944. We're only 1 year short of that and his speech as he was from D-Day. Think about that. That gives you a chill, doesn't it? It's 39 years since Reagan gave that speech. It's 39 years since Reagan gave that speech, which was 40 years after D-Day. Yeah. Yeah.
And is that the one where he says they lost two opportunities? The young men that they, you know, perished, and then the life that they didn't get to live as older men.
Is that speech? And of course the I'll read a little bit of it actually. As we leave the break here, because it goes to the larger question. Well, it gives me hope that when you have boys like yours, that we do still make them, and we still do have that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you, Seth.
Thanks, Elaine.
And,
when do you guys come back? When do y'all get back?
The 30th of June.
All right. So I'm expecting a three-person report.
Okay. Perfect.
At least three. It can be more than three, but no fewer than three.
Okay. Perfect.
All right.
Well, thank you, Seth.
Thanks.
All right, take care.
What an energizing concept, you know? A lot of parents, you know, I listen, going to Europe is obviously a huge undertaking. But when you think about where to take children to visit, does anyone even go to Disneyland anymore? I hope not. I mean, I know they do, obviously, but I hope not. So Reagan in that speech said, we are bound today by what bound us 40 years ago. Isn't that an amazing fact, David? It's 39 years since Reagan gave that speech, which was 40 years after D-Day. It's almost as much time since Reagan spoke that when you think about the distance in time, some of us think of it like yesterday.
Reagan was a successful actor when D-Day occurred.
Yeah. No, some of us. Yeah, no. He lived that span. Sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he said in that speech, we are bound today by what bound us 40 years ago. The same loyalties, traditions, and beliefs. We're bound by reality. The strength of America's allies is vital to the United States, and the American security guarantee is essential to the continued freedom of Europe's democracies. We were with you then. We are with you now. Your hopes are our hopes. And your destiny is our destiny. We're bound. 40 years difference. That electric cord speech of Lincoln's, the one that Elaine is recreating with her boys in a way, is an amazingly important speech. And let's see if I can pull it up. 1858. Just bear with me a moment. It's worth it. It's worth it. It's about, as I said, it's about how you connect new Americans with that of the founding generation. He says, including immigrants, he said, if they look back, he's talking now about immigrants that came to America, if they look back through this history to trace their connection with those days by blood, they find they have none. They cannot carry themselves back into that glorious epic and make themselves feel that they are a part of us. But when they looked through that old Declaration of Independence, they found that those old men say that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And then they feel that moral sentiment taught in that day evidences their relation to those men. That is the father of all moral principle in them, and that they have a right to claim it as though they were blood of the blood and flesh of the flesh of the men who wrote that declaration. And so they are. That is the electric cord that links the hearts of patriotic and liberty-loving men together, that will link those patriotic hearts as long as the love of freedom exists in the minds of men throughout the world. Gives you chills. We'll be right back. By the way, correction on my part, little errata. I was wrong in what I told Elaine, that the speech she was referencing about those who gave up two lives as the Point to Hawk speech. Two different speeches. Sorry. The one I was referencing was, of course, the one I was speaking about, which was the D-Day speech in 1984. The Two Lives speech was a Veterans Day speech in 1985, the following year. The imagination plays a trick. We see these soldiers in our mind as old and wise. We see them as something like the Founding Fathers, grave and gray-haired, but most of them were boys when they died, and they gave up two lives, the one they were living and the one they would have lived when they died. They gave up their chance to be husbands and fathers and grandfathers. They gave up their chance to be revered old men. They gave up everything for our country, for us. And it is our duty to remember. So two different speeches. But boy, you see those tempos are about the same. Anyway, so now you have to read both speeches or watch both on video. David, you had a political theorem, thesis, postulate you wanted to share with us?
I came to this idea late at night last night, and I've come to this sort of realization, and I'm almost happy to declare it that I believe that 2024 will be the year that finally rids us of the idea that people can rise from the legislature straight to the executive office, that we have so many people who have in the past run from the Senate directly for the office of presidency and seen it as a sort of stepping stone when really they're sort of different branches and tools of the powers of our government. I believe that in 2024 we will hopefully be rid of that idea, possibly for good. If you look over the past 8 years, we have this we've had sort of a dearth of senatorial candidates running for president, at least successfully. I think the last one was Kamala Harris, and now we have Tim Scott currently running as a senator. But he's the only one. If we look at the field right now, we have a very large field of people who have executive experience. In fact, the last Republican to run from the Senate and get into the White House was Warren Harding 100-plus years ago. So far,
arguably Nixon from vice presidency, right? But vice presidency on the way, which is an executive office.
Okay.
So
both,
Warren Harding, yeah, really?
It is this blending of both being the president of the Senate and having some executive authority.
Nixon
really made it his own.
Yes, of course.
But he was not successful his first run around.
That's correct.
Running from the vice presidency. I would say that. Perhaps and hopefully we can see the abandonment of this idea. The last person that ran, as we all know, was President Obama.
Yeah.
And well, before that, it was Senator John Kennedy.
Yeah, Jack Kennedy. Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah. So we have this idea of Democrats who run for the White House as senators who don't perform.
No, you need a governor.
Yeah, you need executive experience.
You need executive experience. Yeah, I think that's right.
We
you need
Governor
management.
Bush, Governor Clinton, Governor Reagan.
Yeah.
And so, I am hoping that we are finally rid of this idea.
Yeah, it's probably the right idea. I'm trying to think of successful presidencies that came out of the Senate. I mean, the Democrats will tell you Barack Obama was a success. There's nothing, being so far left, whether he was a governor or not, I'm not so sure that I would have found his ideology successful for America, period. But It's a good point. Lyndon Johnson was a man of the Senate, a short-term vice president, but a man of the Senate. Some would say that was a successful presidency. Some would say not, depending on if you know what you're looking at. I mean, the Great Society was hugely monumental, and it gave us pretty much the constellation. The constellation of that constitutes, you know, all of Democratic Party domestic policy today. But yeah, that's right. That's a really wise point, and hopefully this will do it. Yeah, we don't have, outside of Tim Scott, anyone really running from the Senate, and I don't think anyone else in the offing, right? I don't think so. That sounds right to me. Democrats like to run those senators, though, don't they? Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, Barack Obama. Yeah, they like it much more than we do. And anyway, okay, valid point. Maybe that'll be the end of it. I want to direct your attention, if we don't get a chance to do it today, we probably won't actually, to a great piece at Powerline, Dodging the Social Issues, based on a piece in the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal, John writes, surveys the wreckage of recent weeks and headlines. Here it is. Company's new cause, dodging the culture wars. It is all quite interesting, but here's a couple points worth pointing out. CEOs, this is from the Wall Street Journal, CEOs spent the past few years adjusting to a world in which investors, customers, and employees expected corporate leaders to align themselves with social causes. John asks, did they really? I think that only a small minority of investors driven by the ESG fad were leaning on companies to go left. Likewise, in most industries, the number of employees who pushed management to wade into the culture wars must have been few and concentrated among younger and less essential workers. And was there ever a time when substantial numbers of customers wanted the companies they patronized to espouse leftism? I don't think so. Perhaps a caveat on this for John, but then again, this caveat probably wouldn't surprise anyone, or these companies wouldn't surprise anyone. I would say the California-based companies like Levi, Jennifer Hay went through. Not Jennifer Hay. Yes. Jennifer Say went through. Or you look at some of the Silicon Valley companies, particularly companies like pre-Elon Musk Twitter. John probably wouldn't disagree with that thought. But then again, we wouldn't have been surprised by those companies going down that road. Are you surprised? Are you surprised a little bit that Jack Dorsey has endorsed Robert Kennedy? I am. I'm a little surprised by that. It's a little bit of an endorsement against interest, because I never thought of Jack Dorsey, you know, the original founder of Twitter. I never thought of him as a as someone who would ringingly endorse the kinds of things that Robert Kennedy is talking about, in as far as the collusion between, you know, pharmaceutical companies, the government, and tech censorship. Jack Dorsey was kind of part of the problem. If he wasn't, Elon Musk would not have bought it, would not have bought the company. It'll be interesting to see, too. I see Tucker Carlson has issued now what on Twitter, issued now his first episode of his new enterprise there. That'll be interesting to see how many people watch it and what he has to say. I'll look forward to checking that out, too. All right. I'm Seth, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. David, thank you for reminding me. Yesterday, I kind of teased a piece in the New York Times by Brett Stevens, which was a kind of a commencement address he was giving at the University of Chicago, where he kind of outlined a few theories that I just wanted to talk through with you all and implant with you if you didn't have a chance to read it yourself. It's in a piece he wrote called Go Forth and Argue. It came out over the weekend. And he's telling the students at the University of Chicago how important freedom of speech is, and how important it is to listen to arguments you disagree with, or points of view, I should say, listen to points of view you disagree with. Just to reset it up, I only teased it yesterday. I'm sorry I didn't complete the thought on it. But He wrote, why did nobody at Facebook, sorry, Meta, stop Mark Zuckerberg from going all in on the metaverse, possibly the worst business idea since New Coke? Why were the economists and governors at the Federal Reserve so confident that interest rates could remain at rock bottom for years without running a serious risk of inflation? Why did the CIA believe that the government of Afghanistan could hold out against the Taliban for months, but that the government of Ukraine would fold to the Russian army in days? Why were so few people on Wall Street betting against the housing market in 2007? Why were so many officials and highly qualified analysts so adamant that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction? Why were so many people convinced that overpopulation was going to lead to catastrophic food shortages and the only sensible answers were a one-child policy and forced sterilization? The cases are almost endless and consequences frequently disastrous, and raises the question, why is it that when you bring together a lot of smart people in a room, their collective intelligence tends to go down, not up? Why do they always seem to press the mute button on their critical faculties when confronted with propositions that, as an old colleague of mine liked to say, ought to vanish in the presence of thought? That's actually a better sentence if he doesn't give credit to it. Why do they always seem to press the mute button on their critical fallacies? Why do they always seem to press the mute button on their critical faculties when confronted with propositions that ought to vanish in the presence of thought? You know, we need to do something about that. Ought to vanish in the presence of thought. That's a nice construction. But in any event, it is an interesting point when you have just a bunch of smart people, but they're all on the same page, all from the same viewpoint. Irving Janis, a Yale psychologist, had a book about this in the 1950s. You've heard the word groupthink. That's where it comes from. That's what it is. He said, I'm not sure there's one right answer, but these are a few thoughts based on my own observations and experiences. First, the problem isn't that people aren't smart, clearly. It's that they are scared. I think that's a big point. To yell stop when everyone else says go, or go when everyone else says stop, takes guts. And guts aren't part of any kind of normal college curriculum. In my generation, the hardest people to say no to were the people who had professional power over us. In your generation, I think it's the people who are in your own ideological tribe. Whatever it is, how many of us, if we're honest with ourselves, really have that kind of courage? I think that's an important point, and I think the one I'm so focused on of late is, you know, how could so many smart people get the COVID thing wrong? Now, more and more, when you look at credentials, there's a difference between credentialed and smart, to be sure. And in Washington, D.C., the COVID experts in the federal government, some were credentialed, some were smart, and some were both. But I think it's become eminently clear, at least in the case of Deborah Birx, that they were misleading us deliberately. And I think I can't figure out what Anthony Fauci's game was. I mean, there's a lot of theories. He wasn't honest, that's for sure. And he wasn't open, that's for sure. But he was the one around whom everyone didn't want, about whom no one wanted to contradict. He was the one, seemingly unpossessing man. He was the one you didn't want to be against. You didn't want to contradict. He was the one you had to kowtow to, or at least his point of view. And what were his reasons for being so wrong and misleading, or at least misleading? And I think ego, frankly, in his case, it was ego. He didn't have anyone to be afraid of. I think in his case, it was ego. And for the rest of them, I think it was a weaponization of their credentials and their smarts for a political purpose. That's the one I can't stop thinking about. But there were an awful lot of smart people throughout this country, some credentialed, some not. There were an awful lot of credentialed people, some smart, some not, who just went along with it and didn't want to hear from the likes of what we had to say on the other side. They just didn't want to. And I think they were scared. I think they were cowed. Not by the disease so much, but by being on the wrong side of the political point of how we were supposed to deal with the disease. Anyway, let me come back with some other of Bret Stephens' theses. We'll be right back. threats to our financial freedom and stability are growing. Russia, India, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, China, they're all conducting international trade in local currencies, not the U.S. dollar. Rising interest rates, bad loans, they're exposing the banking system, causing failures. The Biden administration sends hundreds of billions of dollars abroad while depleting our strategic oil reserves and ignoring crumbling infrastructure here at home. However, the biggest financial threat may be coming from within. Central bank digital currency is real. The patents have been filed, and the big banks have released plans for implementation. The vets at Midas Gold Group see devastating implications. The end of cash, the end of financial privacy, big government able to see your every purchase. Could there be ties to social credit? Own private currency. That's gold and silver. Now get free silver just for asking the Midas Gold Group how you can use your retirement to own physical gold. Call Midas Gold Group today at 480-360-3000. That's 480-360-3000. MidasGoldGroup.com. Brett Stevens' piece on Go Forth and Argue, the importance of having an open ear or at least an open mind to – well, an open mind or at least an open ear. That would be the better way to put it. To dissenting points of view, even when you – or in a room full or a group full of people who think you know it all. I gave you the first proposition of his. He thinks some people are scared. They're scared to hear another point of view. They're scared to raise their voice with another point of view. They're scared to challenge the groupthink. Second, Brett writes, there's the problem of rationalization, a smart people convincing themselves and others of some truly dumb things. Rationalization. Robert McNamara. You know who he is, David. Robert McNamara, one of the original whiz kids and probably one of the brighter bulbs in the 20th century of American public life, was one of the fathers of the Vietnam War when he was at the Pentagon, and of the Third World Debt Crisis when he was at the World Bank. Somehow he always managed to convince the other smart people in the room that he was right. Will you be able to notice the underlying flaw in an idea when the arguments for it sound so persuasive? That's a great question. A lot of people, I guess, were talking about a version of the Peter Principle here, where you just keep failing upwards. Have you ever heard of that before, David, the Peter Principle? It's a business principle where you fail upwards to your point of incompetence. You just get promoted along and along and along to your point of point of your incompetence. One of my examples of those was he was at one point Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Warren Christopher. If you look back at history of his jobs, you know, he failed at almost every one of them. Much like the nuclear experts in the Biden administration, those negotiating with Iran and North Korea, they're the ones that helped North Korea get the bomb in the first place. So, yeah, listen to them. Anyway, this is an ongoing problem in Washington. For sure. Then Brett has this interesting third point. Might be the most interesting of the three. So I haven't really seen it. I've seen versions of the other two before. I've heard theories of the other two before. His third one, why people don't speak up, why people don't listen to other points of view in rooms of smart conference. It's a physical dimension. A physical dimension. I have said that totally wrong. Psychological dimension. Sorry, folks. I read it wrong. Need my readers on. There is the psychological dimension. Some people are inveterate truth seekers. They are almost congenitally willing to risk rejection, ostracism, even hatred for the sake of being right. But most people just want to belong. And the most essential elements of belonging are agreeing and conforming. Would-be belongers engage in what's known as preference falsification. That's another great phrase, preference falsification, pretending to enjoy things they don't or subscribe to ideas they secretly reject. They go along to get along because the usual emotional companion to intellectual independence isn't pride or self-confidence. It's loneliness and sometimes crippling self-doubt. Preference falsification. You know, a slight version of preference falsification is when people say they've done things they haven't. Like if you've been asked, hey, did you read this book or did you read that book? Did you see that movie? People often enough in a conversation just want to feel like they belong and feel like they may not get drilled too heavily on it, they'll just agree. They'll say, oh, yeah, sure. Or it's been years, but yeah. Would-be belongers engage in what's known as preference falsification, pretending to enjoy things they don't or subscribe to ideas they secretly reject. Now, I don't know how much of that there was in COVID, but you've seen a lot of this over time, and you see it in the classroom probably more than in a business setting. It's probably much more popular in a classroom setting, this preference falsification, wanting not to be ostracized, wanting to belong, wanting to be part of, and thus going along with the herd. Brett Stevens says, all these factors are to a large extent the product of human nature, of our deeply ingrained instinct to join and stick with the pack, no matter where it leads. But there's a fourth factor, and maybe the most crucial, and it's culture. Does the culture of a society or of an institution encourage us to stand out or to fit in, to speak up or to bury our doubts? Does it serve as a conduit to groupthink or an obstacle to it? Now, the interesting thing about all this is we say and do two different things in America, don't we? We say we want people to, what's the old Apple slogan, think different. Or we say we want people to have courage and the courage of their convictions. We want them to speak their truth. John Kennedy wrote Profiles in Courage because it was seemingly a commodity in rare supply in government or in Washington, D.C. We say we want those things. We say we esteem the troublemakers, in a way, right? The troublemakers of history. Your Martin Luther Kings or your Henry David Thoreaus or your Gandhis. We say we do that, but it's not true. We've told ourselves a lie. We don't actually want that. We don't want that when it comes, at least in the modern academy or in modern political debate. We don't actually salute the dissenter from the conventional wisdom of whatever you want to call the moment we're living in, transnational progressivism, wokeism, neo-Marxism, whatever you want to call this leftist moment we're living in, we don't herald, we don't salute, and we don't encourage the rule breakers or the dissenters, if you will, or the the protesters or the civil disobedience. It only seems to run in one direction. It's bad faith. It was bad faith if liberals were only arguing to, you know, be different and separate from the crowd to achieve a great social good or to achieve a great or better cultural good in society. When it comes to conservatives doing that or someone on the right doing that, it's a lie. They don't want that. They don't want Profiles in Courage. They don't want dissent. They don't want civil disobedience. They don't want you to, as the Apple slogan was, think different or think differently. They want and encourage conformism. And that's probably more the explanation in this realm of how COVID so soaked and saturated our senses and our sensibilities in our country. Anyway, I thought it was worth sharing with you that Brett Stevens point of view and with a few of my thoughts. Be right back. Folks, how do you think the Biden administration is handling the economy? We've got banks failing, stock market volatility, a possible recession coming. What if you could invest in a portfolio with a high fixed rate of return that's not correlated to the stock market or the Fed? Why Refi has that? They have a portfolio where you can turn your monthly income on or off, compound it, whatever you like, with no loss of principal if you need your money back at any time. There are no fees in this secure collateralized portfolio. And YRefi is based here locally. You can go visit them. I encourage you to stop by their offices. They're on Scottsdale Road in the 101. I've been there. I can tell you, you won't get a sales pitch. No one's going to ask you to sign a thing. And when you meet with the team at YRefi, you'll see why I like and trust them so much, and you can too. YRefi is a due diligence approved firm, and you can earn up to a 10.25% rate of return. That's right, a 10.25% fixed rate of return. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or call 888-YREFI-34, 888-YREFI-34. I was just thinking on that last point I was making with regard to the Bret Stephens article. Even within the left, they actually say things they don't mean about, you know, think different or challenge authority or resist or, you know, profile, esteeming profiles and courage or civil disobedience. And if you want proof of that, look at how they are treating Robert Kennedy Jr. He is a man of the left. I mean, do you know who his campaign manager is? I just learned his campaign manager, of all people, probably was, until AOC, the most left-wing member of the House of Representatives, Dennis Kucinich. And Jack Dorsey just endorsed him. Jack Dorsey's a man. Robert Kennedy is a man of the left. I don't care that he has these civil libertarian dispositions. But look at how they treat him. And what's interesting to me is between his dialogues with Elon Musk, his endorsement from Jack Dorsey, excuse me, and I gather it'll become more widely known that he has the support of Dennis Kucinich. He's probably going to get an increasing number of progressive supporters that will take his polling probably in not too distant future, maybe up to 25-30%. And that's why you get headlines like you get today in Politico, which is a publication that came out of the Washington Post originally, or writers from the Washington Post. And the headline is, "What do you do with a problem like RFK Jr.?" He is going to be a gadfly, and I think his candidacy is not going to be a small thing, at least not without an important or large impact for what might be the 10th headache that the Democrats have brought upon themselves with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Okay, Hugh Hallman coming right up. He and I will be right back.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.